is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll explore the question of how much wildfire smoke we've been breathing and what are the health risks.
Clearly and overwhelmingly, this problem is getting worse. It's going to become worse still if we don't act immediately.
Also, grocery stores and large food distributors must start donating excess edible food instead of wasting it.
Shelf-stable items are super easy to hold on to, but, you know, when it comes time to make use of things that are already prepared and have a really short shelf life, that's where it might get a little trickier.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, October 4th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. As our profiles continue on Beyond the Furrows, our series covering farm workers on the Central Coast, we'll introduce you to Maria. She's been on an 18-year quest for U.S. citizenship, and it's been a tough journey. Maria's life has been a series of tragedies, and as KCBX's Francisco Martinez reports, her struggles are not over yet.
Maria will tell you without hesitation. She never thought she would be here right now. Maria says she never thought about putting her life at risk to cross the border because of how dangerous it is to cross. And she says she never thought she would come to the U.S. Here, in this case, is Santa Maria, where the 62-year-old lives now. Maria was raised by her uncle and aunt in Morelia, the state capital of Michoacán in Mexico. She's one of nine siblings with five sisters and three brothers. So when one of Maria's brothers, who left for the U.S. at 13, became a citizen, she says her uncle urged her to go to the United States to get her papers.
Yo le dije que no, y me dijo mi tío que sí.
Maria says she told her uncle no, but her uncle told her to come to the U.S. because she needed to support her siblings. She also says her uncle knew he wasn't going to be around forever or know what kind of life Maria would have. So in 2003, after 18 years of trying to get papers arranged, Maria came to the United States at age 44 with a U.S. visa. She first settled in Santa Maria, then Riverside, then Elgin, Illinois, before returning to Santa Maria. Maria's American journey is an odyssey. She says she was underpaid as a dressmaker in Santa Maria, lost her job as a mattress maker in Riverside due to the factory closing, and was left homeless in Illinois after being exploited by acquaintances. One of Maria's experiences in Illinois left one of her sisters doubting it actually happened. Maria says she injured her foot, leaving her out of work, which led to a confrontation with the landlord. She says she couldn't pay rent, and as a result, she received death threats. Maria says her sister didn't believe her when told, but Maria says she experienced it.
Es cosa increíble, pero yo lo viví.
Maria lived on the streets. At times, she ate just two tortillas a day and became anemic due to lack of nutrition. But she did make it back to Santa Maria, where she says she struggled to find work when she returned, toiling away at a food packaging job until she came across farm work in 2008. She says she loved it, being in the fields. Maria says she feels the earth gives off a lot of vibes, energy, and spirit. She says it's life-giving. But since July of last year, Maria hasn't been able to work in the fields at all. She says she stopped getting hired after she got COVID. Maria says her COVID-19 symptoms were relatively mild, similar to a cold, but she has other health issues that affect her.
Porque yo desde chica padezco de los nervios. Ya sé que me quedé sin trabajo después del COVID.
Maria says she suffered from nerve problems since she was a girl. She also says she's had issues with her right ear. She can't hear out of it, and it gives her problems with her balance. So Maria says she thinks it's a combination of her nerves, her ears, everything. On top of her health issues, Maria says she had a fall in August of this year. She also says knee problems prevent her from bending down and working in the fields. She's hoping to let her knee rest and will try to return to the fields next year. Maria says her knee issues and her fall make her worry about her future as a field worker and feel insecure about her work. That's why she's looking for jobs away from farm work, in the food industry, as a hotel maid, or in a laundromat, but worries her lack of English skills will hurt her chances at getting a job. Maria says finding a job right now is her biggest worry. She says her unemployment checks help her pay the rent for now, but she also needs to find a new place to live. All those challenges are compounded by the fact that in Santa Maria, she's alone.
Yo estoy sola. Yo no dependo de nadie. Para nada.
Maria says she doesn't depend on anyone for anything and wonders what would happen if she gets permanently injured while she's alone. She asks what's going to be of her and wonders what she's going to do. Maria says she's alone because her siblings are far away and also because of family issues. She says if you're an immigrant, you're going to need family support to survive in this country.
Es muy difícil.
Whether someone is documented or undocumented, Maria says life is difficult for immigrants in the United States. She says it's only good for those who have people supporting them. If there's no one supporting you, Maria says it's difficult. But Maria says she feels lucky to even be in the United States in the first place, especially knowing there are many others who are envious of her position.
Muchos quisieran tenerlo y no tienen la oportunidad que yo tuve.
Maria says many want to be residents, namely those who aren't in her position to getting a visa. Getting citizenship means she can feel free. Maria says being a citizen means she can stop worrying about non-citizen problems like renewing her visa regularly. She also says she wants to participate in elections. It's why she's going through the citizenship process.
Pues preferí defender mis papeles.
She says she prefers to defend her residency here and take care of her papers now that she's in the application process. Maria says she doesn't know if she'll get it, but citizenship is her intention. 18 years waiting for a visa to come into the United States. 18 years in this country, working away and struggling to get by. And in those 36 years, Maria has shown continued fortitude and perseverance. The future is uncertain for Maria, whether it's about her job or her citizenship. But her greatest hope right now, she says, is finding a job and getting ahead. Next week, for our final episode of Beyond the Furrows, you'll meet Amancio. Of his entire family, he's the only one here in the United States, and he'll tell you about the simple things in life he enjoys and what it's like to be in this country on his own. For KCBX News, I'm Francisco Martinez.
This episode of Beyond the Furrows is made possible by a grant from the Sunflower Foundation. Our next story involves a collaborative investigation and answers a question that all of us really want to know. How much wildfire smoke have we been breathing and what are the health risks? Dangerous Air was produced using an analysis of federal satellite imagery by NPR's California Newsroom and Stanford University's Environmental Change and Human Outcomes Lab. Reporter Kaylee Wells has more.
Wildfires in California have already burned 2 million acres this year, and that smoke is choking air in the state and across the country. An analysis from NPR's California Newsroom and Stanford University's Environmental Change and Human Outcomes Lab shows a startling increase in the number of days people are breathing dangerous air.
It's gotten to the point where we have fires so much that even like when we have fog, I'm like, okay, is that smoke now or is that fog?
That's Arlene Fleck from Irvine in Orange County, where the number of smoke days has tripled to a full month every year. In northern parts of the state, it's a lot worse. Allison Saldanha is a data reporter for the California Newsroom.
Then you have places like Chico and Sacramento where it's nearly 2 months of wildfire smoke exposure.
The smoke in Northern California is worse because of what grows there. Many Southern California wildfires burn through grasslands and shrubs. Northern California has big, tall trees that burn longer, which releases more smoke for every acre burned. Air pollution from wildfire smoke has significant health impacts across the state and the country. Everything from eye and respiratory irritation to more serious issues, including asthma, heart failure, and early death.
Open it up.
Adrienne Vincent is opening an air purifier in her home.
This gets the smaller parts, the smallest of particles. This is for carbon.
She's been selling them for 25 years, and she's gotten a lot more business lately. September, the start of wildfire season in Southern California, has become a big month for her.
Because that's when people line up to get machines because they can't breathe.
Arlene Fleck has started to see that change at her home in Irvine. We found the number of smoke days has tripled to 30 days every year. She says when it gets bad, she has a hard time breathing and gets headaches.
It's gotten to the point where we have fires so much that even like when we have fog, I'm like, okay, is that smoke now or is that fog?
Last year, Fleck evacuated her home not because of wildfire, but because of the smoke that seeped through the walls of her home. The smoke in Irvine was pretty typical for Southern California. In L.A., the average days of smoke per year jumped from 9 to 32. The smoke was especially incessant in Malibu and Brentwood, home to some of the most destructive fires here, and Castaic, which is a rural community surrounded by dry brush. Health experts say that jump to a month of smoke every year can damage everything, including your lungs and your heart. NPR's California Newsroom found in 2018, there were 30,000 more hospitalizations for cardiac and respiratory issues statewide than just 2 years before. If the smoke in Southern California sounds bad, our analysis found it gets even more persistent as you head north. Fleck had to shoot a movie in Stockton recently, and she said the ash falling from the sky was great ambiance for her horror film, but not great for breathing.
It was pretty rough while I was up there, and I felt so bad for them. I'm like, how do they do this all the time? Like, for us, you know, we have them, but it's nowhere like it has been up there.
We found people in Stockton breathe wildfire smoke for 60 days every year on average. Go even farther north, and some communities are exposed to smoke for 90 days. So why isn't Southern California getting quite as much smoke? UCLA environmental science professor Michael Jarrod has part of the answer.
The fuel load is much greater in Northern California because of the type of vegetation they have.
In other words, the fires here usually burn fast through dry grasslands and shrubs. Northern California has big, tall trees that burn a lot longer, releasing more smoke for each acre burned.
So when those large trees start to burn, they put off more emissions. And although we do get very severe wildfires in Southern California, the fuel load, if you think about it on a per acre basis, is much less. Oftentimes it's less than a tenth of what you would see if you're up in a very large forest with a lot of conifers.
Plus, much of Southern California includes desert and urban sprawl, so there's not nearly as many flammable acres as up north. So even if chaparral is notorious for burning fast and threatening homes, there is an upside. It creates a lot less smoke than the redwoods and pine forests up north. And the result is that here in L.A., we're only breathing smoke 1 month out of the year. In Los Angeles, I'm Kaylee Wells.
In response to this investigation from public radio stations in California, our state and federal lawmakers plan to introduce legislation and hold at least one hearing. Cap Radio's Scott Rodd has more.
Democratic Assemblywoman Luz Rivas says wildfire smoke is a big concern for residents in her Los Angeles County district.
A lot of my constituents are worried about their children and long-term health effects.
As chair of the Assembly Natural Resources Committee, she hopes to introduce legislation to bolster protections for students. Fellow Assemblymember Robert Rivas says he wants to expand enforcement of a recently signed law that guarantees agricultural workers access to N95 masks.
This is something that is going to require that we monitor closely. We're doing all we can to protect the health and safety of such a vulnerable population of workers.
And our investigation got the attention of Congress. Representative Mike Levin is a California Democrat and a member of the House's Select Committee on the Climate Crisis.
Clearly and overwhelmingly, this problem is getting worse. It's going to become worse still if we don't act immediately.
Meanwhile, Representative Ro Khanna, a San Jose Democrat who chairs the House's Oversight Committee on Environment, says he plans to hold a hearing on the impacts of wildfires and widespread smoke. In a statement, Khanna said Congress has no option but to act. In Sacramento, I'm Scott Rodd.
Dangerous Air was produced by NPR's California Newsroom. Next week on Issues and Ideas, we'll explore other aspects of the health risks of wildfire smoke. With the combined goal of feeding hungry people and combating climate change, grocery stores and large food distributors must start donating excess edible food instead of wasting it, according to new legislation that takes effect in January. KCBX contributor Beth Thornton has more.
According to Cal Recycle, one in four Californians have not had enough to eat since the start of the pandemic. Yet every year, more than 1 million tons of still edible food is wasted. Organic waste, which includes unused food, also accounts for 20% of the state's methane pollution from landfills. Senate Bill 1383, signed in 2016, aims to recover 20% of excess edible food statewide by mandating food recovery programs at grocery stores, wholesalers, and large food providers beginning January 2022. Other businesses must comply by 2024. At the food bank in San Luis Obispo County, they are preparing for the possible influx of food come January.
Combating food waste on any level is really important. And obviously food that is coming from grocery stores or restaurants is food that's still safe to consume. And so that is what 1383 is trying to focus on and what we've been focusing on for the last few years.
Emily Hansen is the food bank's operations director. She says the pandemic is contributing to greater food insecurity in San Luis Obispo County.
More of our neighbors are in need than have been before. Prior to the pandemic, we were serving about 23,000 individuals every month. And then at the height of the pandemic, we were sending out 154% more food than we had the previous year.
Hansen says the legislation will hopefully get people to think about how much food goes to waste.
With enforcement of this bill, it will get food producers to also look at how much waste they're generating to begin with.
Willie Wilson is the Food Rescue Programs Manager for the Slo Food Bank. She coordinates with local organizations to make sure food is picked up and distributed where needed. She says some rescue programs are already in place.
Most of the grocery rescue performed in Slo County is actually done by our agency partners. So these smaller organizations, churches, pantries, shelters, they're actually doing direct pickups from grocery stores, utilizing that food to distribute to folks in need.
Both Hansen and Wilson say SB 1383 relies heavily on small nonprofits to distribute rescued food in a timely manner. Wilson anticipates some challenges.
There's so many different types of food to make use of. Some think shelf-stable items are super easy to hold on to, but you know, when it comes time to make use of things that are already prepared and have a really short shelf life once we receive them, that's where it might get a little trickier.
Overall, she says she's pleased that legislation exists.
When I first stepped into this position, it was really daunting because it felt very reliant on pulling on the heartstrings of people. And it's really nice to feel like you don't have to do that. There's legislation now that really encourages them to work with us.
Wilson says one of the large grocery chains already working with the Slo Food Bank is Whole Foods Market. A Whole Foods Market spokesperson shared that the company donated over 27 million meals to food rescue and redistribution programs nationwide last year. Health facilities, hotels, restaurants, state agency cafeterias, and schools have until 2024 to put their programs in place. Kelsey McCourt, the sustainability coordinator for on-campus dining at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, says reducing waste is a top priority.
We don't have a ton of edible food waste. We don't have any like buffet or all-you-care-to-eat stations anymore. Most of our meals are made to order.
She says they use locally sourced food and menus are often revised based upon what's available.
We do a lot of training for our chefs and our cooks on, you know, reducing food waste back of house. We're very good about adjusting our menus to kind of utilize our inventory so that we aren't wasting a lot of food.
McCourt says excess food is currently sent to the campus food pantry for students, and she's still working through other details for SB 1383.
I think a lot of planning will go into this, but I do think it's a good thing. And, you know, not only is it helping to reduce food waste, but helping to support our community and those who might need it.
Cal Recycle has resources for businesses and nonprofits to help prepare for SB 1383. You can also contact your local food bank. For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
This report is made possible by a grant from the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. KCBX contributor Brian Reynolds speaks with author Dorothea Deli about her new book, Saying Goodbye to Your Dear Dog, 10 Questions to Help You Decide When to Euthanize.
Dorothea, could you tell us who you are and where you came from and how you got to this point of discussing this wonderful book?
Thank you, Brian. I got my first dog when I was 7 years old, and I got my first typewriter right around the same time. So dogs and writing are definitely my two most favorite things in the world. And I remember when I was about 30 or so, I lived in San Luis Obispo, and I actually started nesting. I crocheted a little baby blanket. I bought these cute little squeaky toys. I even went to the library and I checked out a couple books about how to potty train. It was time to adopt my very first dog as an adult. And so my husband and I went to Woods Humane Society, which is there in San Luis Obispo. And we ended up adopting this cattle dog. And the moment I saw her, when she looked into my eyes, I just knew that she was my soulmate. And I named her Collie, and she had the biggest personality of any dog I've ever met. And she was always up for adventure, which I really appreciated. And then, of course, as happens, time went on. And eventually, when Collie was about 15, she started having some kidney failure issues. She had some heart issues. And unfortunately, we had just moved. We had moved from Colorado to Nevada. So we didn't really have a vet here that we could work with. And I just picked the closest vet, you know, who had decent online reviews. Honestly, it was really, truly one of the most difficult things that my husband and I had ever been through together, because even though we had had pets as kids, we had never been the ones making the decisions about them. You know, Mike and I just felt like we didn't know who to turn to. We didn't know what to do. We were really confused. We felt scared. And I think because we don't talk about death and dying in our culture, we really felt alone. It's just not something people bring up usually. And so I did what I usually do when I'm struggling with something in life. I started writing, and I just wrote and wrote and wrote. And then after Collie had passed, I started interviewing other pet parents. And I just asked them, you know, about their experiences and what do they wish that they had known when they were facing end-of-life decisions for their dogs. And then I interviewed a couple of veterinarians. And eventually we all kind of as a group came up with 10 questions that we agreed really would have helped us make this decision when we were facing it. And so I ended up putting in different people's stories, putting in these 10 questions, putting in a lot of research I had done. And it was lovely too. I was able to draw on some of my experiences working at Hospice of San Luis Obispo County. And the whole point was I just didn't want another pet parent to feel as scared or confused or as alone as I had felt. So that's how the book came to be.
Because we care about our dogs, care for our dogs as they care for us. Just, I'm looking at the title of the book here, and it makes me want to run the other direction, because it's a topic that looms over all of us who have pets, but it's just not something we want to approach. And I'm sure it's not just cultural, but it's the idea of losing someone you love, and maybe even being involved in making that happen. It's a very daunting thing. So first and foremost, I would salute your courage in doing this and kind of pushing back against our societal norms of not confronting certain truths of life, because life, I joke, this is really a bad one, but life is a fatal disease, and we know what's the outcome of it's going to be at some point. We just don't know the circumstances. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I salute you for that. And I also, I guess I would note that if we're lucky as human beings, we might meet a soulmate in our 20s and stay with them the rest of our lives. But a pet, if you live an average age in this country, say 70, 80 years, you're going to be loving and losing 8 to 12 times in your lifetime, each one brutal. To me, that makes pet people special.
Yes, I love that you say that, Brian, because we go into that relationship knowing that we will more than likely outlive our pets. And yet we open our hearts to them and we love them and we're there for them at the very, very end. You know, I actually opened the book with a quote from Brené Brown. She says, "The bravest among us will always know heartbreak because those are the people who have the courage to love someone."
Yes, to love and lose. I would like to remind everybody that I'm Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by author Dorothea Dele, who's written a book called Saying Goodbye to Your Dear Dog, 10 Questions to Help You Decide When to Euthanize. One of the things that struck me really to the quick was your experience of moving away from vets and other support people that you knew to basically to be strangers in a new land. But the difficulty of finding and getting involved with a vet that can be a good fit for you and your pet at that most important time. What, do you have any advice about that, about what to look for or things to maybe avoid?
I think it's really important that you feel rapport and trust with your vet. Now, some people I talked to felt that with the vet that they were working with, and so they didn't feel the need to, you know, get a second opinion or something like that. But for me, what I really noticed is the person listening to them, to me? Are they taking me seriously? Are they answering all of my questions? Those are kind of the what I've learned anyway to look for in a vet. Someone that looks at my pet the same way I do, which is, you know, my family member.
Well, just to clarify that, because I think it's such an important point, you're not just looking in some cases for a second opinion, i.e. another vet to confirm what the other previous vet told you in terms of price and treatment and all the rest. But you're really saying that there might be some vets who are not a good fit. And as a pet owner on a mission, you need to, or the person needs to have the courage to look elsewhere. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I would agree. It's just like taking care of yourself. If you're working with a, you know, a medical doctor that for whatever reason you feel uncomfortable with, you know, you absolutely should look for someone else. You know, especially when we're talking about end-of-life care for our pets, we don't want... Well, what happened to me is afterward, I was filled with so much self-doubt. You know, did I do the right thing? Did I do it at the right time? Did I wait too long? Did I not wait long enough? And it was so confusing, and it was something that I think one of the reasons that we created the book is that it has a lot of worksheets in it. So you could sit down with your vet. You could bring these worksheets in and you could say, you know, here are the physical changes I'm noticing. Is it anything we should be worried about? Or here are the personality changes we've noticed. Or my dog started to withdraw. You know, whatever it is, it kind of gives you like a something concrete to bring in to your vet to discuss with them, just to make sure that we're all on the same page. Because although you and I both know a big part of your decision-making will be your intuition, there's also something really important to consider some of the kind of more objective changes that you notice in your pet. It's kind of like a combination, I think, between your head and your heart. And, you know, obviously most vets are going to be focused more on the head part of it, the intellectual part of it, which I absolutely think is wonderful. That's what we want them to do. And so, but yeah, at some point you also want to feel seen by them. They have a hard job. I mean, several vets I talk to, it's a difficult job.
Sure. I'm just going to mention when our second collie, when she died on the steps of the vet, I think of a broken heart because her other friend had gone just 2 or 3 months earlier from cancer. I was overwhelmed, and I something happened in the vet's office. Anyway, we both started crying, and we hugged each other. Of course, this is pre-COVID. I'll never forget it, that he was affected and I was affected, and we both comforted each other, him as a professional and me as a pet owner. And it was, I'll never forget it. It was huge.
Yeah, that's so kind. It's just being there for each other in truly what's the hardest moment.
Maybe talk a little bit about some of your chapter headings. What are some of the broad categories in the book that you might describe for our listeners?
Well, I broke the book into three parts. So the first part is to ask your vet. And so we've got a couple of worksheets in there to take in to your next vet appointment and questions you can ask, but there's also space in there to write in some questions you might have. The second section of the book is ask your dear dog. Since our pets can't talk to us, we're paying attention to their behavior. This whole concept of quality of life is pretty confusing, and so I tried to break it down into specific areas for pet parents to pay attention to. And of course, a big one for a lot of people is, has my pet given me a sign? And then the third section is ask yourself. The final question really is, you know, what does my heart tell me to do? And I also have a section, once you've made your decision, and either way, you know, whether you've decided it's time or it's not time, the goal would be to just help you know, is it time or is it not time? Is it closer to time? Is it, you know, just kind of gauging that. But once you do decide, then I've got a whole section that helps you put together an end-of-life plan for your pet. And I found this so helpful with my second dog, Jenna, because now I kind of knew. I knew where she would be when we euthanized, or she would be at home. I knew who would be doing the euthanizing. I knew what method that vet was using. I knew what we would be doing with her afterwards. So all these questions that you're right, you don't want to think about them, especially when you're distraught. But if we are able to think about them and get them written down, especially if we do that in advance, then when the time comes, it's just one less thing to worry about. In fact, I think it's one of the most loving things we can do for ourselves, is to prepare for that. And then I also have a section for people who have children. I know talking to kids about this is also challenging. So there's a section in there about talking to your kids, depending on how old they are, and then just some ideas for ways they can be involved, maybe in a memorial service, something like that. That's the general layout of the book.
One of the things that really struck me, and we haven't mentioned it yet, but there's the normal or typical scenario of an older pet needing, you know, the owner and the dog to think about, you know, end of life things. But this can happen in their youth. They could get hit by a car. Mm-hmm. They could develop a tumor. And I think some of your stories in your book talk about that. It's happening, but it's not happening on the schedule you think it should.
Exactly. I did talk to a few folks who their pets were young. And like you said, the dog developed a cancerous tumor and it was inoperable. And he was just a few years old. And so that's the other thing I think about, is it's not just for sick or aging pets.
If you would be so kind, Dorothea, could you read two or three of the selections from your pet parents?
Thank you. I'd love to do that. This first story comes from question 5, which is my dear dog withdrawing socially? And this is the story of Bailey. John Thompson's Labrador Weimaraner mix, Bailey, loved to play catch. You couldn't throw a tennis ball enough times or far enough for her, he says. She was a joyful soul with a ball in her mouth. Bailey was loyal, too. She was always by my side, John says, often with her head in my lap. As Bailey aged, she slowed down. At first, John noticed little changes, like her not being able to hop out of the car or not wanting to chase the ball as often. When you start seeing those behavioral changes, John says, they're coming on so slowly, you don't really realize that your pet is in a lot of pain. It wasn't until Bailey stopped hanging out with the family and spent most of her time lying in the back hallway that John understood just how much pain she was in. She just wasn't herself, he says. No interest in companionship. After several false starts, John finally made the euthanasia call to the vet. When the vet came to their house, John took her to the back hallway and sat on the floor next to Bailey. He gently laid her head in his lap and petted her as the doctor gave her the injections. Bailey relaxed for the first time in a year and a half, John says. It hadn't been so obvious to me how much pain she'd been in, how much she was holding it in her body until there was just this relaxation, that letting go. It hurt to lose his constant companion of 15 years. It was also a relief because now Bailey was at peace and not in pain anymore. I think Bailey was ready to go, John says, and it took me a long time to get there. The attachment was completely mine. I put Bailey through a year of unneeded pain, and I regret that. I miss her head, he says, in my lap, and just rubbing her ears. Bailey had the softest ears. I miss those general moments of camaraderie and love.
Wow, that's very, very moving. I think we have time for one more.
I will read you then one from me and my dog, Collie. Has my dear dog given me a sign? I wanted a sign from Collie that euthanizing her was the right thing to do. A sign so obvious that I'd immediately feel at peace because I'd know beyond a doubt, with 100% certainty, that it was time. But it didn't work that way. Instead, Collie and I shared a quiet moment that I chose to interpret as a sign. No fireworks, no magic, just the juxtaposition of the following two moments with my kid, Collie. One night when Collie was about a year old, she cut her paw while digging in our backyard. She hobbled into the house and found me at my desk. She held up her paw to show me her bloody wound, and her eyes seemed to say, "Look, Mom, I'm hurt. Please make it better." In that moment, I felt like I truly became a dog mom. This was my first baby's first boo-boo, and she trusted me to help her. I yelled for Mike and then ran to the bathroom for supplies. By the time Mike found us, I had taped two maxi pads to Collie's leg. We rushed out to the car and arrived at the emergency vet hospital 20 minutes later. They seemed to sense we were new dog parents and were very sweet to us. After a quick exam, the vet assured us that Collie's wound was superficial and it would heal just fine with a couple of stitches. I had saved my dog with feminine hygiene products. Now, fast forward 15 years. I was lying on the couch reading when I felt someone staring at me. I glanced up and I saw Collie, who had been sleeping a moment before, looking right at me. The look in her eyes made me catch my breath. In a flash, that memory of her first boo-boo as a baby came back to me. And just like all those years ago, her eyes seemed to say, "Look, Mom, I'm hurt." Collie was tired. She was in pain. "Please make it better." Only now there was only one way to make it better. Only one way to end her suffering. And that was to end my baby Bubs's life. In that moment, I became a dog mom in a deeper way than I ever imagined possible. Because I loved Collie, I would let her go.
We have to end it here. I'm sorry we could go on and on, but I'd like to remind everyone that I am Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we were joined by author and pet owner Dorothea Delly, whose book, Saying Goodbye to Your Dear Dog, 10 Questions to Help You Decide When to Euthanize, is available online. And Dorothea, could you tell us your website?
That is goodbyedeardog.com. And we have a couple of the guide sheets up there. We've got some video interviews with different pet parents and other support materials.
Great. Thank you so much. And thanks for being here today.
Okay. Thank you, Brian.
And finally, Father Ian explores the choosing and preparation of fresh pomegranates in Playing with Food. This episode originally aired in October 2019, but with pomegranates coming into season locally, we wanted to take a fresh look.
The amazingly bright red Mideastern fruit brightens up the dull days of late fall and early winter. I remember eating them as a child, something special and very rare. But then, one day while researching a segment of Playing with Food, I came across the most amazing flower I had ever seen.
There's these beautiful kind of bushy trees with these bright red flowers on them that I've never seen before. What is that?
These are pomegranate trees. So we have four pomegranate trees here, just a funky looking shrub.
And then you start to see these little red buds form, and then comes this flower, and then the flower kind of closes up, and it balloons up and hardens, and then finally you have what you recognize in the store as pomegranate. And it's just amazing to have grown up, you know, having the occasional pomegranate. And then it's a totally different experience to have actually watched that fruit grow from seemingly nothing into a full fruit that I recognize and enjoy.
That's Kenny Chisholm at Westmont College in Santa Barbara. And he's right. It's so amazing to watch this flaming red flower turn into something that I had only previously enjoyed from the grocery store. So I went on yet another quest on the Central Coast. On the way to a winery in Paso Robles' west side, the side of the road was dotted with red. "Slow down!" I yelled at my Angelino driver and friend. As she slowed, I saw that the red dots were pomegranates. So I took to the internet to find the farmer, only to discover that they had ceased operations. Then, a year later, a jar of pomegranate jelly appeared with the name and contact information of the local producer.
My name is Susan Moore, and I'm the owner of Morning Glory Farms. I produce jams and jellies. This is Bradley, California, probably one of the most northern parts of San Luis Obispo County. This is very rural.
And there began this journey to discover the pomegranate on a very busy road, despite being in one of the most remote spots in San Luis Obispo County. And you will hear the cars passing by.
So these are two of my trees right here. My other trees are a little smaller. Since I do source from another grower, I don't have a lot of my own. There's a couple that are almost ripe here. The pomegranate season is late fall, early winter. So a lot of them will still be green. This is what I have here. I've trained them to be more like trees so that I can get up underneath to pick.
What kind of growing conditions do they need?
They need sun. I do like to give them plenty of water. The warm summers are great for them. I don't think a frost is that good for them, but I've had frost and it hasn't hurt their flowers at all.
The flowers. If you haven't seen the flowers of a pomegranate, you must search them out in the summertime. They are truly remarkable. So I told Susan my story. Okay, so speaking of flowers, I was doing another interview and I came across this bright red flower that I'd never, ever seen before. And it was a color that I'd never seen in nature before. And I said, "What is that?" And he said, "That's a pomegranate."
Well, it starts out as a beautiful flower, red flower, like you said. It has to be pollinated, and then it will start to grow into a little green pod that gets bigger and bigger. And then once it gets to the right size, it will start to turn red. Let's see. I did see there was one right above us, right over there.
Yep.
So so this one's not quite ripe, as you see. Both of these. There's two right there. They'll get a little bit bigger, and then they'll turn ripe. Then I just clip them to start to process them. They will keep in your refrigerator for a couple months, you know, fresh like that. Now, if I were to clip this right now with it being green like this, the seeds inside would be white, and they will not ripen.
So it doesn't ripen off the tree?
No, it's one of the fruits that will not. Some fruits do. This is one that doesn't.
Does it taste bad when it's not ripe?
Well, it's bitter. It's bitter. It's not sweet yet. So the more water I give it, the sweeter the fruit will be.
So you planted these trees yourself?
Yes.
From clipping or from a seed?
You know, I bought them in pots.
How long does it take for it to get to its first fruit?
You know, probably, I'm trying to remember now, I've had these trees for a long time, and I think it was probably about 3 years before it had the good big round fruit.
Yours are shaded by another tree. Is that intentional? Like the ones on the road were right in the sun.
No, it's not intentional. This is a walnut tree, and it's just become so prolific this year. I've actually cut it back quite a bit, but I will trim it back once it's finished fruiting its walnuts. It's not meant to be shaded like that. It just has grown that way this year. So this tree doesn't have a huge crop this year, just as my pomegranates don't have a very big crop. And I think sometimes they just rest. The last few years I've had like prolific amounts of walnuts and pomegranates. This year I don't. So trees sometimes they just need to rest a bit. And then next year I may have a huge crop again.
The pomegranate, or at least Susan's, has an unlikely pest.
I do have squirrels that get them too, and I don't spray or use pesticides or anything. You know, it's hard to keep the birds off it as well. And I do have a woodpecker that can be invasive from time to time.
That's from a woodpecker.
So woodpeckers like the pomegranates?
Mm-hmm. And they're looking for bugs as well. Yeah, he's probably trying to drink the juice, get some seeds in there.
What kind of pests do you have for the pomegranates other than woodpeckers?
We don't have any pests on them. I don't have anything that is a danger to them.
The growing is simple. You have a bush or tree, it needs sun and water, and you harvest when ripe. So let's find out what to do with the fruit. Susan makes pomegranate jelly. So how do you use them? Obviously, you probably just eat them like they are. Do you eat the whole seed or do you suck off the pulp off the seed?
I do it both ways. The seeds are a great source of fiber, so it's good to do it that way. I do like to suck the juice off the seeds as well. You know, I throw it in my salad from time to time. The other thing, too, is I do make jam for my business out of the pomegranates, too.
Can you do anything other than jam?
They're great for marinades, salad dressings, sauces, things like that. I know friends who have used it as a marinade, and I think they create the marinade, and the pomegranate juice goes inside it.
Okay. Can I see what you're doing with your jam?
Yes.
Great.
Yes. So we'll have to go up to the house where I do all my processing.
Okay, great. I'll follow you up there.
Okay.
Great. We wind up her driveway about a half mile to the farmhouse and straight into the kitchen.
So I should tell you that my kitchen, this is where I do a lot of my operation. I am a Cottage Bee licensed business. So I am licensed through the county to operate in my kitchen. I'm inspected once a year through the health department. I think it's a great thing to have for people to have a small business without the expense of a commercial kitchen that you would have to rent space at and everything. Cottage A is where you sell directly to the consumer. Cottage B, you can sell with a third party.
Susan wasn't actually in a position to make a batch of jelly. She hadn't harvested yet, but she talked me through the process.
This is basically what I do here. Wash them really good first. I'm going to get a bowl. So I'm going to fill it with cold water. And while that's filling, and I usually use a serrated knife because it works much quicker. So I cut the ends off like this. So those are ripe. That's great. Then I do this.
Just cut it right in half.
Mm-hmm. And I cut it in quarters like this.
But not all the way through.
Yes, just like it'll be easy to break it open. Like that. Okay. And then I just take it and I break it open like this.
Break it open in quarters.
In the water. And you just pop it open like this and the seeds will just come right off and they don't break. And they'll float to the bottom eventually. So any of the membrane that gets stuck on there will float to the top. So I basically just go through that and do that with them. So I'm getting ready to get pomegranates from that ranch and mine put together and then process it all.
So when you get the pomegranates, how many pounds of pomegranates will you be dealing with when it all shows up?
It's hard to say. It just all depends on what we have time to pick and what we can get. You know, I don't go by pounds. The most I've ever had is about 500 pomegranates at a time.
And how long does it take you to just to get the seeds out of them?
3 days, maybe, to get through them all.
Doesn't your back hurt standing over the sink by then?
Yes.
And your hands?
Yes. Well, I get a big stool and I sit there after a while.
And who helps you?
Well, I have a lady that helps me. She and I do it together.
You have all of those seeds in bowls, I'm assuming, all over the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just start putting them through this domestic kitchen-sized juicer.
Yes, yes.
And how long does the juicing take when you have 500 pomegranates?
Oh, probably 2 days.
Okay, actually, that's not bad, but that's 2 8-hour, 10-hour, 12-hour days?
7 hours, 6 or 7 hours. And then, you know, we take breaks. My granddaughter likes to come over and help as well. She likes to operate the juicer. And then even my husband will jump in there and help me too when I need some help.
So 3 days to get the seeds off, 2 days to juice, and then you start making jam.
Yes, yes. And then I start making batches of jam.
Making pomegranate jelly is very similar to other popular types of jam.
Pomegranate is pretty easy. I make 4 batches. I do it in fours, so 4 batches at a time. So it's a matter of, you know, measuring out the juice. You put the juice in the pot, measure out my pectin, sugar. I buy 50-gallon bags of sugar at a time. So you measure out your pectin that you need and bring it to a boil. You have to stir constantly, and then you add your measured sugar in.
boil it again for a certain amount of time. And then I have my jars ready to go. I use 8-ounce jars and I start filling the jars. The four batches, and we have jars laid out across the, you know, the counter there. Once they're all filled, I wipe off the rims. I have my lids ready to go, and you boil your lids for about 60 seconds, pull them out of the water, and then you start putting the lids on. From that point, when they're hand tight, I put them in boiling water. I boil them for 5 to 10 minutes. That seals them and then kills any bacteria that might be in the jar. And then you pull them out, let it cool down, and it gels at that point. And then I wash my jars and I start labeling. I try to keep this pretty stocked so I can pull for customers. People call and say, I want 3 jars of pomegranate, 2 jars of apricot. I just pull it from here. These are always ready to go. I have people that buy it for their peanut butter and jelly. I have people that use it on their bagels. They use it on their croissants. I've had a customer that was using it in, they use it in their recipe for their restaurant. A customer that has a coffee shop in Ventura, he uses it on one of his sandwiches. People use it in all different ways, not just on toast. It's also great paired with a cheese on a cracker. I would probably say like a goat chevre. It would be great with that, yes.
And this all got started by accident.
I think it was like 2007. My mother and I would plant our gardens. My mother lived here with us. I grew up with her canning and making jams. And so one year we had such a prolific garden that we did a bunch of jams and canning. And we went to a country fair at Bryson Hesperia. It's past here about another 20 minutes up in the mountains. And I got a little ad on it. And I said, well, let's just go set up a table and see what we can sell. Well, we sold out. And people asked for more and more and more. So it just turned into a business. We worked it as a business up until about 3 years ago when my mother retired from the business. So now I do it on my own. And I have a couple of people that work for me.
So it was my turn to play with pomegranates. Here's what it was like. From pinching, picking, to pulping, to partaking. I'm back at the pomegranates at the side of the road. They're actually harder to pick than I thought. Lots of cars going by. But these are bright red. Try to get some pomegranates. Here's a nice one. Beautiful red. Okay, let me get 2 more. There we go. I've got a bag full of pomegranates. So I have this big pile of pomegranates that I picked from the side of the road, and I'm gonna process most of them into juice. I'm gonna do exactly what Susan told me, and I'm gonna partially quarter them and then take out the seeds underwater. So this first one I opened isn't ripe because the seeds are still white. There's a little pink on them, but they're mostly still white. The next one I open, all the seeds are red, and I'm just gonna peel away like she told me to underwater. I'm gonna do about 15 of these pomegranates. I got about 2 cups of seeds from about 14 pomegranates, but that's not quite accurate. About half the pomegranates were not ripe. The seeds were white when I broke open the pomegranates. So that was really disappointing because I got the brightest, reddest pomegranates I could find on the trees. I did notice when I was picking some of them that where the stem of the pomegranate attaches to the tree was a little bit drier than others and they were easier to remove. And that's typical of fruit being ripe. And so I tried to get those fruits, but clearly I wasn't successful. So I feel really bad that I wasted some fruit that can't be harvested by other people or animals. I'm going to take these 2 cups of pomegranates. I'm going to put them through my food mill to see if I can get some juice out of them. So I've added some pomegranate seeds to the food mill, and let's see if the food mill will work like Susan's juicer. So there's this pulp and there's this pink liquid. Ooh, it's nice. It tastes like pomegranate. I was going to make 2 dishes with my fresh pomegranate juice. One was a Middle Eastern dish with lentils and pomegranate juice. And then another was Brussels sprouts with a pomegranate glaze. However, with the disappointing amount of juice that I got, I decided to just do a taste test. So I bought 2 things. This juice that is 100% mangosteen juice plus pomegranate. I don't know what mangosteen fruit is, but we'll give it a try. And then I bought a jar of 100% pomegranate juice from concentrate. So I'm going to try the mangosteen and pomegranate. There's not much to it. It's just kind of a sweet, nondescript juice. Then I'm going to try my juice. It's actually quite nice. It's a lovely juice, and it'd be great mixed with soda water, which I might even do. Let's try this pomegranate juice from concentrate. It's very different. It tastes darker and deeper. It actually tastes like grape juice, and I think I actually prefer the pomegranate juice that I got from my pomegranates, because this other pomegranate juice genuinely tastes like grape juice. The fresh pomegranate juice was by far the best way to enjoy it. Everything fresh is better. I've used pomegranate molasses in Middle Eastern cooking, and it's definitely worth giving that a try. Though, I would say that, however few bushes there are, it's easier to find a fresh pomegranate on the Central Coast than pomegranate molasses. I did pour my juice into some sparkling water, and that made for a refreshing mid-autumn drink. Like Susan said,
it's very delicious. It's very healthy for you. Pomegranate jelly is something that you can't necessarily find in a grocery store. When you find someone like me who makes it, it's just a real treat.
Seek out the fresh pomegranate this and every autumn. This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.